Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Ben Peace, a seasoned professional with a rich background in licensing and marketing. Ben currently serves as the vice president of APAC at WildBrain CPLG. A psychology grad from the University of Warwick, Ben has harnessed his academic insights to excel in various leadership roles. His journey includes impactful positions at Hasbro, where he was the senior licensing director for Asia, and at Universal Pictures, contributing as both the commercial and retail marketing director for APAC and the global licensing director. His expertise spans from retail marketing to business development, demonstrated through his prior roles at Universal Pictures and International Entertainment and Procter & Gamble. Ben's diverse experience, coupled with his leadership and licensing across the Asia-Pacific region, underscores his proficiency in driving business growth and strategic partnerships. I've asked Ben to join us here today to share his story and discuss how we can all do more with our marketing and licensing opportunities. So Ben, thank you so much for joining us, my friend. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, good. It's good to have you here. Great smile. That was a good smile. I know I did the bio right when I come back. You smile like that. I'm like, okay. Now, you hinted at this before we got started, before I hit record, but I always like to ask, how did you even get started in this? Marketing, business development, licensing? I already know the answer, but the audience doesn't. Do you come from a background of this? Were your parents?
I don't think you'll meet anyone that comes from a rich legacy of a licensing background. And I don't think you'll find many people that really aim for it, to be honest. It's a somewhat idiosyncratic place to be. I definitely don't have a background in it. So you mentioned I did a degree in psychology, and then I got here through a chain of events, through jobs in fast moving consumer goods, retail, and ultimately in entertainment. And it was through that path, the entertainment piece, that took me from content into content licensing and then into kind of product licensing. Yeah, it's been an interesting journey to get here, but definitely one that wasn't planned.
So you said content to content licensing, now into product licensing, is that correct?
Yeah, so the licensing I do now is really quite broad, but the steps were really when I was at Universal Pictures, I was doing direct sales. So back in the days when DVD and Blu-ray was still a huge global business, I ran the Universal Pictures UK home entertainment sales function, and they needed someone to help run their licensing business in Asia. So basically licensing out the right to sell DVDs and Blu-rays in different markets. So I moved out to Asia doing that and ended up running their global license out business, which was all about content. But then they needed someone to set up their consumer products business. So all of their kind of merchandise publishing and promotions. So that's then what got me across into that kind of even deeper into the world of licensing. And I've been doing stuff along those lines ever since.
Obviously, you seem to enjoy it. I feel like licensing, and part of why we reached out to talk is licensing, I hear very exciting things from people that are good at it. It's probably the best way to put it. Because a perfect example is I know someone that was presented, they built a successful business in the States. They had a few locations. They were considering franchising it. And what they actually ended up doing was licensing it. And for them, it was exponentially the smarter decision in terms of bottom line ROI and just litigation exposure, all this sort of stuff. For people, like, what are some of the biggest challenges that you faced in trying to figure out licensing? Obviously, when your employer wants to handle licensing, they want you to do it right the first time. What are some of the biggest lessons that you've had to learn?
I can talk about lessons I've learned, but maybe for the sake of people listening to this, you mentioned franchising versus licensing. And so maybe just interesting as a starting point to just talk about what those kind of fundamentals are. But then certainly I've learned plenty of lessons. So licensing can really be any legal framework where you're giving someone the kind of opportunity to use something of value. Licensing occurs in the music industry, in technology and content, all sorts of different fields where you're saying, okay, I have something of value. You're going to use this for whatever purpose, to make something, to put something on TV or what have you. And what I do at the moment is licensing in mainly in kind of consumer products. So it's more brands. So it's not technology, it's not music, it doesn't tend to be content. It's a brand or a character, a mark that someone recognizes and thinks that is a value. They've got an affinity for it.
Or like the typical like Disney, your kid buys a t-shirt with a Disney character on it. The Disney isn't a t-shirt, but they're getting a percentage for the use and likeness of whatever character that is.
Exactly. Disney are really the masters of this. They've got so many different characters, brands, movies, TV shows that kids and families, everyone loves. I currently work with Peanuts, the Snoopy folk, and same thing. Everyone loves Snoopy, young and old. And so whether it's on a cap, a t-shirt, a backpack.
He's 4 months old. We got a dog 3 months ago. His name is Peanut after, because he's a beagle. Snoopy's a beagle. Anyway, just putting that out there. I hope I don't have to pay anyone any money to use that name.
No, that's wonderful, especially that you knew that he's a beagle. Some people don't know that Snoopy's a beagle, so well done. exactly as you said. So all of those different products and services and the sort of a t-shirt with Snoopy on it or with Mickey Mouse on it or any kind of beloved character is the more obvious one. It goes way beyond that. So, you know, when McDonald's are doing a Happy Meal, when you use your bank card and on the bank website, there's some kind of a promotion using characters. It really is anything, product or service. Generally, it's not that brand that is doing it themselves. So Disney don't own factories that make t-shirts. They find trusted partners that are experts in textile and manufacturing and that have got great distribution into markets globally to sell great t-shirts, working with the likes of Inditex Group, with various retail outlets, and working with Uniqlo or whatever. You can name 100 different apparel manufacturers and retailers. They're the ones that take on the license. They're the experts, and the licensor then works with them and they grant them the right.
Right. Yeah, CrossFit's another example people know where they were the fastest growing fitness franchise loosely used in the history of the planet. And there was a license. It was just an annual licensing fee to use their name. And basically you could teach whatever you wanted. You had to do their certification program and you had to pay the licensing fee and then you were in business. And if you wanted to do something different, you could, so to speak, but there were rules around what you could and couldn't do type thing. You couldn't, but ultimately at the end of the day, they didn't tell you. It wasn't like a franchise where there's a really strict, like what kind of music you can play or can't play or what kind of uniforms people have to wear. There wasn't that level of control. It was mostly you can use the brand name, the likeness, and you can certain kind of member kind of vernacular can be used for things which are trademarked in that. So yeah, we were talking about the franchises versus licensing. Is that a fair example?
Yeah, it's a good example. And we could talk about the difference between those two things alone for an hour. But if you imagine Subway do a lot of the franchise model. So if you go into a Subway store, you have the same experience. Like you say, people are wearing the same outfit. It's the same product pretty much. They source it from the same places, but they're not running it themselves. So I put my hand up and I say, look, I think people love Subway. And in my town, there isn't a Subway. So I'm going to take on that franchise. And it's a replica of what they do elsewhere. Whereas with licensing, you're more being given, granted the rights to use the Subway logo. And maybe I'm doing that in slightly different ways. And
right.
It's in some ways a bit of a blurred line, but I would say that the franchise model is more rigid. The license model is more fragmented and is somewhat more flexible. And depending what's in that contract, you can do things a little differently. One thing that does make it a little more confusing is that we also in entertainment speak, talk about franchises. But we talk about franchises more, the overarching kind of all of the different elements of a brand that go to market.
Like Lucasfilms or Marvel, the Marvel movies. That's a franchise. It's a movie franchise, but it's actually like a brand and a licensing deal type thing. So what are some of the lowest hanging fruit? Obviously, you've been in this You've been in this industry for a number of years. Obviously, when you go around or you have friends that have businesses and that, do you feel there's low-hanging fruit that more entrepreneurs don't take advantage of that they could or should, that you think are just solid ways to approach it?
Yeah, absolutely. The starting point for licensing is all around demand. So if you've got awareness for a brand and you've got affinity for a brand, people know about it and they think there's some value there. That's the starting point. And from that, you can look at licensing kind of anything and anywhere. But the crux of it is, okay, where is that demand? Where is that awareness? And it could be that in the USA, there are brands that have been gradually expanding globally with their core product. And it could be that that brand's really loved in certain places, and that there are consumers in Indonesia or in Spain or in Iceland that would love product with that brand on it, but they're just simply not available.
Right.
And so that's the real, the lowest hanging fruit is where there's a ton of demand, a ton of awareness, a ton of love for some kind of brand, but there just isn't the product. And that happens, honestly, all the time. And we're constantly chasing to catch up with the demand, find the right product and fit that to the people that really would love to buy it.
So maybe there's a book that's incredibly popular, but it's in French. And so you license the rights to the book, you translate it to English, and now you are the de facto distributor in this one or handful of English speaking countries. And I'm just going to ask what I'm thinking. Is there a better way to structure these? What I mean is, in that book example, is it a commission, almost like a commission per sale thing, or is it front loaded? Like, you got to pay us $1 billion to use this, and then 1 cent for every book. Is it, you get what you negotiate at the end of the day? What are people hearing this? I know there's probably people that maybe have something that they feel they could license to others, but
it's a good question. The basic model you've got, I feel like you more about licensing than you give on, Daryl, but publishing is a unique category because it's a very unique product and experience. It's entertainment within itself. And the market globally for publishing is pretty consolidated among only a relatively small number of companies, certainly on a global level. But the answer is exactly as you described it. If you take your example of a French book, or I really love everything that comes out of Japan. So if you look at the kind of anime and manga that comes out of Japan, that's an example where the Japanese that don't want to do that in France, they want to find a partner that can get their product into France. So if you take that, a manga, a comic that's done really well in Japan, there are loads of partners that would love to get their hands on that. So they say, okay, I would like the rights for France, say, and they'll translate it, they'll distribute it, they'll make sure that it fits for a local consumer. They want all of the Japanese, the flavor to it, but they also maybe need to figure out, okay, how do we make it work for our local market? Then you mentioned the deal structure. It really can be anything, but generally what the brand owner wants is fair and scalable compensation for the IP relative to the opportunity in that market. So if in France they're like, look, we know that the French love manga. They love that there's a rich history of anime and manga coming across, and we've got an amazing property. And therefore, number one, we want it to be scalable. So like you said, a cent in the dollar for every manga that's sold, we want our fair share of that, because we've got to give that back to the people that drew it and thought of it and all the hard work that's gone into it. And we want a commitment to the scale of business that you're going to do, that you're going to make sure that it gets distributed all over the country, and you're going to do some marketing around it, and you're going to speak to the trade about getting it released. And so generally there's a minimum guarantee against that deal. So you say, you're going to pay me up front this amount, and then you're going to give me a cent in the dollar for every manga you sell, and you can recoup that against that initial investment, and hopefully you'll exceed that and then be paying kind of overages on an ongoing business. And normally those deals are done for kind of two or three years.
2 to 3 years. Got it. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, you mentioned that I seem to be a bit savvy. I've read a couple of books on it, but I feel like I've let so many opportunities slip through. There's a couple of people I really admire that have become incredibly wealthy through simply wrapping a few licenses together, so to speak, or where they get. A perfect example is, this is older, like before we had online movies, but he basically licensed the right to put a stand in, almost like consignment in, it wasn't 7-Eleven, but it was that sort of like a convenience store. But then he licensed the right to be able to take unused inventory and just pay per piece, essentially, that gets sold 30-day net. And so he basically would set up the stall in the convenience store, and then he'd take the unused inventory and put it on the stand. And And then he'd go check it at the end of the month and take back anything that didn't sell. And he would just make a tidy profit. And he set up multiple locations of this. And all he's done is he's taken unused assets. So they say OPR, OPC, OPM, other people's resources, other people's customers, other people's money. So he took the inventory that was just sitting in a warehouse and he just took some of it out of the warehouse and put it in a convenience store. And the owner of the convenience store agreed that they would do inventory and pay him whatever per unit sold. And then end of the month, he'd come in, they tally it up, he'd get paid, and whatever didn't sell, he'd put back in the inventory as if it had never been left. And so there's a lot of ways. Yeah, what do you...
That is indeed an awesome model. That's not technically licensing. So basically what that is it's a consignment retail model. So when you've got product being sold on consignment, the transaction as it happens to the consumer is what then triggers the wholesale payment back. So that the retailer, instead of buying it up front, saying, okay, I'm buying a pallet or whatever, an end cap of all of these products, and then, so I'm taking ownership of the product and then I'm selling it to my customer. Instead of doing that, they say, I'm not going to take the risk or exposure on the inventory. You're going to maintain ownership until it goes through the register. Right. But as soon as it does, I'll give you all of that cost. And if it doesn't sell, I'll send it back. And that's the model they've used for a long time on things like newspapers, because the thing is, the next day a newspaper is of no value. And so they don't want to take, like now I've used a whole load of my capital to buy a load of newspapers that haven't sold. So I'm not interested in that model. Instead, they want you as the publisher, you take on that exposure. And as the retailer, it's risk-free. And so your friend that did that, it's a smart move on a couple of levels, because the convenience store guy is great, because this is part of the store I don't need to worry about. I just make the money on the sale.
Sweep around it. We're good.
Exactly. But your friend, whilst there's a bit of exposure on the stock, he's getting the shop for free. Right. So he doesn't have to worry about the retail point. So it's
the lease, the having pillar products that bring people there over and over again, all that sort of stuff. That's what I'm talking about, because I think there's a lot of opportunities. And maybe we can talk about protecting your IP as well. But there's even if you have a method for doing something, I believe that you can license that out, whether it's a way of baking a particular pie or making sorts of cookies. If you have a farming technique that's unique versus others, a lot of this stuff are things that you can essentially license out. I wonder, how does someone determine, a lot of people listening to this and a lot of business owners are so busy in their main business, how do they do the cost benefit analysis to determine whether it's worthwhile or not? Is there a back of the napkin method type thing?
You mentioned the sort of on the more technology side of things, which is that's more about kind of patents, which is still absolutely, you can still like license that stuff. The business that I'm is more related to copyright and trademarks, but essentially it's the same thing. Still, it's something of value. The difference with a patent is it's something specific in terms of design and normally more kind of design and technology, and it's sufficiently unique. And you've put sufficient effort into making this widget that you then go and register that patent, and then you have the opportunity to then license out that patent. So Einstein famously was a patent office clerk many years ago before he became the world-renowned physicist. So that's been going on for a very long time. It's a very old practice. But essentially, it's the same thing. So you've got the design of some kind of technology, you could license that out, or you've got a brand or character or some of the kind of mark that you're licensing out. Same process, just slightly different back end. I think to your question on how do people make the assessment as to whether this would be a smart thing to do, I think it's really understanding who the potential customer is of whatever it is that you're doing, whatever your sort of brand is. So if it was on the technology side, and like I say, I'm certainly not an expert on that side of things, but if that technology is not making its way to people in a certain part of the world, and you're not meeting that need by distributing your specific product, then you could license it out. You could find someone else that has got the capacity and capability to make something similar. So they've got a factory and they've got a distribution network, and they can do it for you under license. Mm. And so it's really all about demand.
Right.
So with a good, an interesting example outside of entertainment, we work with lifestyle brands at Wildbrain CPLG. We work with UK and US universities, for example. We work with one of the Formula One teams, the stake currently Alfa Romeo, in the future is going to be Audi Formula One. We work with fashion brands and fashion accessory brands. And in those cases, it's exactly the same process, but maybe a little less obvious. If you think of Yale University, incredibly well-known institution that people recognize with incredible learning, education, and a rich history. And in the past, if to wear a Yale sweater or t-shirt, it was alumni, it was people at the universities being proud of where they went to university. But there's a whole load of people all over the world that know and recognize that mark, that have a degree of awareness about the university. And it's something aspirational. They'd love their kids to go, or they just love that brand. Right. And so we work with the team at Yale to do programs. We build licensing programs in all sorts of places. In India, we've got a business there. They've got a huge business in Japan and Korea, in China. And so that you might not think, if you were sat at Yale University, you might not have thought, okay, this is going to be a big opportunity for us to do apparel in India. It's not an obvious fit. But the team at Yale University, great team, really forward-thinking, collaborative set of people, they were never going to go and do that themselves, but they found an agency who could work on the ground in those territories I mentioned. We don't represent all of them, but they've got different agencies that they work with globally to go and find partners in the apparel space particularly, but also accessories and some others, recognizing that there's demand, that there's brand value that can be translated elsewhere, and then finding someone that can go and help you go about it.
Yeah, okay. I think I'm with you on this. So it really all starts with the not most businesses start this, should start this way, but there has to be a demand or a proven demand with a certain type of people. And then what you're doing essentially is trying to find trusted partners to reach everyone. Right. And that's basically the smartest way to use it. Is it very legal intensive to do this? Is that something that might make it a little bit prohibitive? Obviously, there's lots of contracts, and I mentioned we'll come back to it talking about protecting your intellectual property. Is this something that becomes very litigious very quickly in the sense of to get the deal done and then even afterwards to, we talked about lessons learned.
Yeah, we started with me not answering that question. So the short answer is that there is always a legal framework. It is the bedrock of the agreement. It's a legal contract that grants the allowance for the use of whatever it is. And it's very specific. It's okay, so which territory can you have? What is the brand that's being licensed? Is it the logo and other derivative, maybe marks around the logo or character or whatever? So what's being licensed? In what territory? For how long? Against what categories? And often then a whole load of other stuff which relates to the way that product goes to market. Is it only for certain retail channels? Is it, well, all those things I mentioned against certain
limitations,
categories,
requirements.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I think within that, you also, as a brand owner, you want your partners to be good partners, trustworthy partners, and operating with integrity. And the last thing you would want is that someone's making a great product, but they're doing it in the wrong way. Right. And the sort of the negative publicity that could come out of that, and just the potential negative impact, whether that's to do with working conditions, maybe in the factories. Or so the legal framework covers not only the way that the product's going to look and show up, but also how it gets to market. And all brand owners these days, or certainly all the brand owners that we work with, would care about the way it goes to market, as well as the product that ends up in market. So yeah, the important legal framework, relatively consistent, I think, in terms of the bare bones of that, but different licensor to licensor does it in slightly different ways. But that's what, yeah, that we do a lot of it, because every single partner we work with, there has to be a legal contract in place.
Right, of course. What are some of the biggest mistakes that you see people making, or that you've learned, or the giant potholes to avoid?
So really thinking about, we talked a lot before about the sort of the demand piece. Sometimes, and this has happened many times, because of big demand in one part of the world, there's an expectation there'll be big demand in another part of the world. And therefore going to market with a whole load of fantastic product. But if the demand isn't there yet, then you end up actually with a pretty horrendous circumstance, because not only does the product not sell, But all of the retailers that see that product not selling thinks that's a brand that doesn't work. And so you lose the opportunity there and then, but you also burn the opportunity for the future. Because maybe you build the demand over time, you create awareness and people end up loving the brand. But the retailers, and I've seen this before, and I was stuck with a whole load of inventory. No one in my, yeah, maybe it works in the USA, but in my market, it doesn't sell. And so it's really important that you get the order of events right, that you're really sure that the demand, awareness, affinity are all there before you start getting products and services and all the licensing business going behind it. I guess that's one critical one. Overexposure of a brand is another. So it's related to that, but not quite the same. So when
conflict of territories, or
well, more just when once a brand's big, just going, just whoever comes and knocks on your doors willing to give you money, just giving them a license. Because with some of the biggest brand owners, there are times when demand just goes through the roof. Sometimes there's just that magical moment where, because of a movie or TV show, there's a character that people just are desperate for. It really hits that kind of zeitgeist. And honestly, those moments are truly a license to print money, pardon the pun, because everyone wants it in every single category. And you might get 10 different companies all in the same category that are willing to give you money. But you know what? That's a short-term sugar high that very quickly you get a hangover from, because all of that product shows up. It doesn't look coherent. They don't make all their money back because they're like, I'm the person making the product X. But then they find out that actually there's 9 other people in market doing the same thing in the same channels. So from a customer experience, like, there's too much. And from a licensee experience, there's too much competition. Overexposure, two sides to it. So one, from a consumer perspective, there's just too much of it and they get sick of it. Or from a licensee perspective, there's that you find
slight money on this. I don't want to license it. Yeah. That sounds like a delicate balance.
Thinking about the way that you do licensing, you really do need to look at it long-term. It should be a game that you're playing over 2-3 year stretches and trying to look as far into the future as you can and thinking about every single consumer touch point. So as a brand owner, you're thinking about, okay, what content do I have? What marketing am I doing? What consumer products do I have on the ground? What live entertainment experiences have I got? And many more, publishing music, there's all sorts of stuff. And really thinking about, okay, how's that evolving in any given market over any given time frame? And who do I want to partner with to make that a really amazing consumer experience? If you always think about the consumer first, think about what they'll see when they walk into a store, what they see when they go to a theme park, what they're watching on TV, what content they're getting on TikTok and on Instagram, then you're in a much better place to succeed. If individually you're just firing off all of these different elements, then you might be successful, but you're not really charting your own destiny.
And what about protecting your IP? Because obviously you can try to have requirements to maintain quality control. You can limit territories to try to protect your licensors, that there's enough market there that they're going to make money and want to continue the relationship. But how do you protect the IP? A lot of people, I just go to Google Images and download a picture of Big Bird and then just slap it on a t-shirt. And now you paid for the license. I didn't, but we're both selling Big Bird t-shirts. So can you, yeah.
Yeah. And that happens a lot. It used to happen way more. Technology and just the way the product goes to market has actually helped that a little bit. But the bottom line is, yes, you as an individual could easily get hold of an image and start selling your Big Bird t-shirts. But if you go to Inditex and say, in Zara, it'd be great to see Big Bird on t-shirts. Do you want to buy this license from me? They're simply not going to buy it from you.
Yeah.
You're not Sesame Street. So you can only get so far with that. If you want to sell on a market stall, you might be able to get rid of it, but you're not going to get too far. So one is that there's a little bit of a limit because most credible players, they want the actual license. Number two, consumers want legitimate products.
Yeah.
If you go and you see a knockoff product, some of them, and don't get me wrong, some of them are done pretty well, are pretty good, but normally the quality isn't so good. The way that the brand has been represented, my team represents all of our brands for product development. We have experts that understand brand assurance. So, take Big Bird as an example. I'm sure my friends at Sesame Street wouldn't mind. They want to make sure that Big Bird is always represented true to that character. The height of Big Bird versus the height of Cookie Monster needs to be right, because they're part of a world that needs to be consistent. And so we would look at that and we'd make sure that the copyright line is on there, and we'd make sure that the materials and quality right. So from a consumer perspective, you get a much, much better product. We do ultimately police it. Retail now frequently want to police it themselves. So even in China, the likes of Alibaba and the many onliners over there, or Lazada, Shopee across Southeast Asia, in the past, they just wanted the sale. So they don't care if it's legitimate or not. But because now their consumers want it to be legitimate product, they don't want those people selling it on marketplace or direct or in any which way, because then their consumers are getting a bad experience. And if you think about Amazon, their mission is to be the most consumer-centric retailer in the world. And most e-com players want to do the same thing, or at very least keep up with that kind of ethos. The retailers do a lot of that themselves. And what we do is we're always looking for any legitimate product, and we let retailers know if they're selling it, and they are normally pretty good at very quickly taking that off sale.
Yeah, I love that. I may or may not have mentioned it when we talked, but in 2020, I spent about $50,000 US. And our 10 assistants helped me go through all the academic literature on business success, small and medium-sized business success, from all around the world, to try to figure out what are the key critical success factors. And we identified 8 critical success factors. And one of them, obviously, is marketing strategy. And once we identified the 8 factors, we started drilling into each one individually to break it into its subcomponents. And with marketing strategy, we actually found one of the key pillars of marketing strategy is corporate social responsibility, which breaks down into community development, ethical values, and conformity to legal processes. And that's part of, and I think that's a really, and it, also the other one is brand integrity and trustworthiness. And that's transparency, customer-focused USP, authenticity, brand consistency, and clear brand purpose and promise. And so it's just, people know that if you're gonna screw somebody else over, it's only a matter of time till that person is me. And so they want to do ethical business with ethical people. And so it just, I actually really liked how you brought that up. You might get away with that small time. It's a great example. I bought this guy's course once. He was like, how to do Facebook ads with an unlimited budget. And I was doing Facebook ads. I'd actually helped someone do $1 million. And Facebook ads was part of our strategy. This is, again, years ago, 2014, 15, somewhere there. And I buy this guy's course. I'm interested. And his course is about, you sign up for a new Facebook ad account, and they give you $100 in free credit. So you spend it. And then you sign up for a new Facebook ad account, and you get another $100 in free credit. So you spend it. And in my head, I'm like, this guy's never going to do $1 million with this. Like, you're going to do what? You're going to make 3 sales. And then what? You're going to make 1 sale. It was that short. I wanted my money back. I'm like, this is the most dead end marketing strategy in the history of things I've seen lately. So it almost feels like that. They might be able to do the knockoffs and maybe they'll make some money, but these will never become big. They'll never play with the big people. They'll never play with the big boys. People want to do ethical business with ethical people. They want to play long-term games with long-term people. So it sounds as long as you dot your T's, cross your I's, and you mentioned it a few times. So it really sounds like the biggest thing is making sure the demand is there. The demand is there for something that is unique to you. And then you get the proper affairs in order. Is there, like, what would you recommend to someone starting out or struggling with this? Someone's, okay, I've got whatever. I've got a curriculum. I've got some characters. I've got a widget and I want to license it. But they're starting out and they're struggling. What do they need? What's the starter pack that they need to get going?
I would say that the first thing, because you mentioned there the different sort of walks of things that could be licensed out. I always go back to what's the kind of the fountainhead of the demand. So if it's a movie, then it's the film. And it may be that you do some like marketing around it, you do books around it or whatever, but you're starting off with a film. Or it could be a book, and you might end up later doing a film from the book, but it's the book that everyone fell in love with. So what's the starting point and getting that right first, getting a really great core business, that's what's going to drive your demand. So it might be an entertainment product, and they're the ones that may be most easy to think about. Book and the publishing is another. Toy is another. There are some products, which start off in toy. So the core demand, the fountainhead of demand, comes from toy. So get that right first. Make an amazing product. Hopefully you get a bit of a moat around it so that it can't just be easily something similar copied or something substitutional. And once you've got that, you can then gradually build out first from kind of adjacent categories. So take the toy example. You make your toy, but then around that, there could be accessories and similar toys, novelty toys that might be somewhat similar. And because people know and love the core product, then they're probably going to like things that are somewhat similar. And you can gradually go further from the center. If you're making a toy, to suddenly go and start doing a deal with a bank to put the image of a toy on a bank card is probably not going to make so much sense. Mm. But doing something which is maybe an outdoor play experience or something that sort of is similar to the toy, or maybe an activity book that's got elements of the toy. You're doing stuff which is closer to center, and then you gradually build out, and the bigger it becomes and the bigger the brand and the awareness is, you can go further and further from that center point. So my advice would be get right whatever that core proposition is, and really understand who the consumer is that buys that product and loves that or service. Who are they and why do they love it so much? And then think about, okay, so what other things can we do, either because they relate so well to that consumer or because they relate so well to the core product? Mm. And that would be my starting point, and then build out.
Mm. That's a great tip. Where do you see the future of this going? Now that we've got AI, there's issues around a lot of these AIs being built on other people's IP. We've got, it's an interesting, you talk about, I was going to ask 5-10 years, but apparently you live in 2-3 year cycles. So let's start with 3 years. Let's spend this out. What's coming down the pipeline that you think, you know, you're keeping an eye on, that you think other people in this field perhaps want to keep an eye on as well?
Yeah, again, AI is a conversation we could definitely do a separate hour on. I think that it's a technology and change that I'm spending a lot of time looking at. I think it's like electricity 150 years ago. It's going to enable and change everything. It's not a narrow use. It's an incredibly broad use technology. And it's very difficult to see the ways in which that is going to disrupt, but it's going to disrupt almost everyone and everything. And I think the world in 5 years is going to be very different as a result. I think specific to licensing, the immediate sort of obvious areas which are already being looked at is really about kind of ownership of IP, both where you've got generative AI in kind of imagery, if it's being trained on trademarked imagery.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're like, do something in the style of Ben Peace, and then I'll put this out there. I grew up on Tupac. I listen to classical. I really do. I listen to stuff from Ukraine. Man who raised me was deaf in one ear, half deaf in the other, and he had a record library that would rival almost anyone. But Tupac is what I grew up on, and recently there's been AI, new tracks, his voice. Yeah. All this stuff, and there's a couple I'm like, man, that is him. Like that, I love it. But like you said, that's his brand, his likeness, his pain, his life journey. So sorry, not to interrupt, but
no, but that's a great example. It brings it to life. So I don't know in that example if it was done by his estate or if it was done by who owned the rights or if it was done by someone else. But the reality is you've got potentially a whole load of training data that's being used. And that was owned by someone at some point. But if it's in the public domain and that's come through, and what's now been made is unique. So is the owner of that whoever had the initial material, or is the owner the one that's now made it? And because it's been made partly by a human that's had some impact, but partly also it's the technology that's allowed it. It's the ChatGPT or whatever. And so you've got all sorts of conflicts of who owns it otherwise. The Europeans are probably furthest ahead on this. So they've recently passed legislation which they are looking at the fact that you can't use copyrighted material within the training data for like large language models and the like. If you try and go into Midjourney and some of these image generators and say, show me X brand, so some of them will do it, but a lot of them now increasingly won't do. And I think what will happen is it'll become a license model. So if you pay a premium account on Midjourney, then those images and a bit of the money that every time someone says, I want a two-pack image, a couple of cents are going to go back to the owner. Same with music on Spotify. If you're like, okay, I want it to sound like Tupac, but I want the lyrics to sound like they're from Leonard Cohen, and I want it to be on a samba beat, then that can go, all of that can go back, because you pay, instead of paying $9.99, you're going to pay $19.99, because you're going to get super premium AI Spotify, and that delta is going to pay the back end rights holder. So I suspect that's the way that it will go, but it's going to take a while for us to get there, and probably a few legal months.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And it makes sense. I'm sorry, I'm collecting my thoughts on this. It makes sense that there's public domain versus when somebody creates something, they should. The internet is very much a proponent of all knowledge and information should be free. We went through that with music and movies. But I think there is, like, if you want movies, the people got to get paid, and there has to be an incentive for them to do the work to make the movie that you want to go see. So if you're just going to pirate it and put it for free online all the time, they lose that incentive, therefore the quality, it's almost like a balancing act that the natural forces will play out to a certain extent. What are some of the habits that you feel are most important to succeed in this? We've talked about certain things, make sure demand's there, all that stuff. But in terms of over the long term, if someone was getting into this field or just trying to succeed licensing content, are there habits weekly, quarterly, annually that they need to have?
I think outside of the sort of general sort of disciplines that you need in any kind of business, one of the critical ones is really being fleet of foot and being able to take advantage of changing trend and market dynamics. A few years ago, fidget spinners suddenly were selling everywhere, but you can't see them anywhere now. Here in Asia, they were on every street corner in every store for maybe 6 months, but and now they're gone. You can't find those anywhere. And so you could do branded licensed fidget spinners, and there was a whole load of money to be made. If you were really on the pulse, you saw that trend coming, you quickly found partners and could get to market. Fantastic. If not, that trend comes and goes, nothing works. You don't make any money. If it's the same with what consumers want in a broader sense. You mentioned before corporate responsibility. A lot of that genuinely comes from corporations wanting to do the right thing. But a significant part of it is because that's what consumers demand. So if consumers want us to know that their product has come from a fair and sustainable supply chain, and that the packaging is recyclable, or the packaging has been reduced, you've got to keep up with that stuff. And sometimes that's legislative, but the smart people are ahead of what they're being forced to do, and they choose to do it. They look at ways of taking it to market without additional cost, and there's additional value as a result. So I think a long answer to the question, but really being fleet of foot and moving according to where trend is changing, consumer habits are changing, consumer demand is changing, which it involves, keeping your ear to the ground.
Yeah. What I love about the licensing is, again, it's... I have come from the belief that businesses solve problems, and that's why they get paid. In licensing, it's almost like you're solving the problem of almost being a super connector versus being the doer of the thing, or even the deliverer of the thing. It's being able to put the deals together. The example I gave, which you're right, was more of a consignment deal, was basically the idea that this guy had found, what do they call it, trash can assets for these people. What's in the inventory in the warehouse is not useful for those people. And this plot of space is just empty, and he just sweeps it. It just collects dust for this guy. And by being able to identify those and doing deals with them, licensing it, he managed to create a really lucrative opportunity for himself. And that's also part of why I feel like we've just seen the largest wealth transfer in the history of the planet for the last 3 years. For whatever reason, people want to think I'm of the nefarious camp, but other people may feel differently. But either way, it's irrefutable that the middle class lost $3 trillion or so, and the upper echelon managed to make, look at that, $3 trillion something. That I think it's really important that people become more savvy on how to create value and opportunity. And that's why I really appreciate you coming on here to talk about this, because I think it, for someone to wrap up something, I've even actually heard that term, wrap up. You buy interest in a few different, it's not, I don't know if there's licensing, but you basically roll together a bunch of businesses in an industry to create a super entity in the industry. And the customers can all be shared between all the different businesses. They all So now all the marketing expenses, the lifetime customer value goes up exponentially, because now instead of business A only having product A, B, C maybe to sell, it's been rolled up with these two other businesses, and there's 12 items in the product line now. And this is where a lot of people don't necessarily realize, I'm on a bit of a soapbox here, but somebody comes to you for help with a problem. As a business owner, you can help that problem, but you can also offer other solutions that maybe for the problem they're going to have. I told you I bought a dog. Now the dog needs to be trained and I need dog stuff. Maybe there's a monthly subscription box of, you know, dog treats and toys and stuff like that type thing that you could be, whether it's an affiliate, and maybe, I don't know, you can speak to that, but as an affiliate or somehow you license this stuff. So now you can offer more value and become more of a one-stop shop for things. Can you speak to that a little bit, like that mentality, maybe any examples to help illustrate this for people, how it can be used? I feel like I'm grasping at straws here because I'm not the licensing expert.
You touched on a few different things that I would say. Firstly, so at the moment I work for a global agency, and there are some other great agencies out there. And all of us, like you say, we act as consultants. So we work out, okay, how do we help a brand broaden their reach, further increase their awareness, affinity, all of those things. And so that would be a good way of describing what we do. I think on the idea of helping people think about how they could be part of a, I guess, rather than going it alone, you're part of maybe more of a collective and making money as a result. The wealth, without getting into sort of that wealth transfer piece, there have been all sorts of things that have happened over the last few years. And I think whilst a lot of big companies have got bigger, there's no question, the barriers to entry for smaller companies have reduced.
Right.
So while Amazon might be now just a colossal retailer with a huge, people talk about digital feudalism. They now own the digital land on which everyone else has to pay rent. But you can, the barrier to go and sit on that land and you're paying rent, but you can get to consumers very easily. In the past, it was very difficult, very expensive to get to that consumer. Now you can do that as an artist on Spotify. You can, in the past, you needed record labels behind you and you needed the infrastructure to print DVDs, very expensive, massive barrier to entry. Now get on your phone, record something, and you can put it on YouTube, you can put it on Spotify. And if you're an amazing artist, then you can get out there. So I'm a sort of an optimist on these things that, yeah, there has been on one hand some challenges and the big got bigger and the rich got richer, but there were also massive reductions in barrier to entry.
Yeah, oh, I agree. Like just the survey data, if you want to survey a market, you talk about knowing where demand is. Pre-internet, you would have to have people with clipboards going out, paper and pen supplies on site, finding these people, tracking it out. I can sit on the toilet right now and I can go through forums and groups online and I can read comments. I can look at keyword search data. I can go look at reviews of products all over the internet, and I'm wiping my butt with toilet paper. And this is, I'm getting quality research that I can, with $20, set up an ad campaign and at least figure out if there's any interest or not on this appeal to this type of person. So I agree with you wholeheartedly on that. Are there any sort of ideas or examples that you have come to mind about combining licenses to create some sort of super opportunity?
We work on partnerships all the time. You sometimes can be surprised at the most disparate brands coming together and bringing two communities together, to the affinity for two different brands together, and that being even bigger. It tends to be doing that kind of short term, because what people love is that this is a moment in time when you're seeing two brands connect, and there's urgency to be part of that while it's available, because it won't go on for the future. Nothing sort of springs to mind that where that's been done, and it's a very long and enduring thing. But short-term partnerships all the time with big fashion houses, for instance. So with the Gucci's and Dolce and Gabbana's of this world, they'll do short-term partnerships with character brands maybe. And consumers love it because it's this one time when they're going to get these two things showing up together. North Face have done some interesting ones. North Face, obviously, it's mountaineering gear and the great outdoors. And they've done some programs with just out and out entertainment brands. And you think, surely these things don't fit together, but consumers absolutely love it because it's the one, maybe I love climbing a mountain and I also love character X. And it's the one time the two are going to come together. So it's a great way of introducing both brands to new consumers. And it's a great way of creating a moment in time to participate in both those properties.
Right. So, and it might be a good way to give an old product a new look type thing, I think is another way to put it. Or introduce it to a new market. Maybe, I don't know, I have a very lame example, but maybe your hiking boots are mostly bought by older middle-aged men, but now you put the Naruto character on it. You talk about manga, and now all of a sudden it's millennials are now interested in it type thing versus, so I think there's a lot of value in that. Ben, I want to be respectful of your time. You've given such an abundance of info on this. I've got a couple of pages of notes. Is there anything I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
I don't think so. We've covered a lot of ground. It's like licensing is a very broad church, so it's difficult to get too deep into it. But I think we've covered a lot of it. It's been interesting. It's been fun.
And if people want to get in touch, if they have questions, if they want to learn more, what are some of the best ways for them to get updates from you, get in touch?
Yeah, good question. So the agency that I work for at the moment, Wildbrain CPLG, you can find us on the internet and contact details to get in touch with me and my team through the sort of get in touch link there. Myself on LinkedIn, certainly more than happy to answer questions and speak to people about licensing. So happy for you to leave the details on your link.
So is that cplg.com? Is that the domain?
Wildbrain CPLG, I'll give you the various handles of ours and you can put them in the links.
Okay, I'll put those in the notes. For people that are just listening, if you're driving or something, you can look up Ben Peace on LinkedIn, BenPeace. You know you've got the right guy if he's in Singapore working with Wildbrain CPLG. C is in cat, P is in peanut, L is in laugh, G is in goodness. Wildbrain CPLG, you can take an internet search for that or look up Ben Peace on LinkedIn. Ben, thank you so much for coming and joining and sharing, knowing you have your own direct reports, your own projects, your own interests. Thank you for coming and sharing with my audience and I so we can all do a little bit better.
Appreciate it, Al. It's been good.